Blog Talk Radio.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca road, when along came a semi with a high-end canvas-covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca, Mac, with me you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. I travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Barranquilla, and Padilla. I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Boston, Charleston, Dayton, Louisiana, Washington, Houston, Kingston, Texas, down to Monterey, Faraday, Santa Fe.
It's time for the next edition of the Riveting Jumble Justice Radio Show, broadcast worldwide on Blog Talk Radio. Turn up your speakers and listen closely, since you may be asked questions later. Keep your phone handy, since we encourage you to call in your comments to the host and guests on today's show. The listener call-in number is 347-996-5983. Once again, the number is 347-996-5983. You will also find the number on the top of the homepage for the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I'm Audrey, your technical and spiritual advisor for the radio broadcast. And now, without further delay, allow me to introduce your eminently qualified and inspiring host for Jumble Justice, Professor Keith Haley.
Muchas gracias, Audrey. Yes. Thank you very much, Audrey, for getting us on the show. We have a couple Border Patrol stories tonight. Yes, our Border Patrol is still out there, the ones on the ground doing the job, trying to stop illegal immigration, while the administrators high up and not so high up are doing some pretty silly things, and we'll comment on that later during the news segment. Welcome to the Blog Talk Radio Network and the Jumble Justice Radio Show. This is our 8,000th show. No, it isn't. How many is it, Mike? Who's counting? But somewhere, you know, 4 years plus, 4.5 years actually, every week. I think maybe we missed one when the technology didn't work somewhere down on the Appalachian Trail. But it's a lot of shows, a lot of hours wasted. No, actually, 3 or 4 people actually enjoy the show and use it in their classes. But I'm your host, Keith Haley. I want to thank Johnny Cash for taking us on that trip again across the country to 90 cities and states. Try singing that song if you haven't done it. It's hard to do from memory. But Johnny Cash used to do it that way. Emily, thank you very much for being with us tonight also, and for your work on the news. And Emily's had a tough job tonight because as she sorts through the news that we store on Evernote, which now I think we're going to start calling sometimes Note, Evernote's going through some type of upgrade and redesign, and some things have been lost. In fact, one of my news stories I just found out here after going through them, the news story has been lost, but I'll remember the silly part of it that I want to tell you about. Anyway, it's one of those Border Patrol stories. But the purpose of our show is to discuss news and issues, events, developments, and this difficult, sometimes humorous practice called criminal justice, police force corrections, juvenile justice, at all levels of government and international. Our show is dedicated to those energetic and tireless people who work in those segments of the criminal justice field. And what we try to do is take an inside look at criminal justice and its professionals as they do their work. And tonight will be a good example of that. We're going to use some clip again. We're going to have Chief William Bratton and Dina Temple-Ranson is going to interview a couple of police chiefs and an expert from the CIA about cooperation and sharing intelligence information on radicalization. Very controversial idea is who gets tagged radical in the United States nowadays. And they're going to discuss about sharing information between various levels of government, federal, state, and local. So I think you'll find it very interesting and something that's close to my mind. All right. You're listening on Blog Talk Radio Network. Who's counting? Literally thousands of shows a day now are broadcast on this. And guess what? You can have your own show. So it's any person, any interest group, any organization. I tell people about this, and they just, you know, kind of smile at me. They want to broadcast, and I guess you can do everything off of Facebook now. What? Can you eat on Facebook? I didn't even know. Do they serve dinner on Facebook? They might. I've heard a lot about Facebook, but for those of you planning to work in the criminal justice field, a lot of the administrators and executives in that field, they do not get a Facebook page. It's not so much what you put up there, but it's what other people put up. And so your participation on Facebook is probably not the greatest idea if you're going to work in the field of criminal justice. These shows that we do, they're archived almost immediately, and they can be downloaded in MP3 format if you would want to use them. Again, you can slide through my silly portion of the show that I start out with and get to the featured speaker or whoever we have on tonight or that night at the featured item. So get your own show. If you don't like what you're hearing, you can have your own. And, boy, there's enough to choose from here tonight during prime time. Yes, we're a prime time show. We haven't upgraded to that point where we get pictures and all that. I don't want to scare people away. Pictures of the host and crazy little symbols and all that, but if you go on and look at 9 o'clock right now, the Blog Talk Radio, you'll see all kinds of things. Anyway, if you want to call in tonight during the new segment of the show, we're going to move along pretty quick because I do want to get to this segment on radicalization, intelligence information, and you can hear the rest of it. I'll give you the data when we start in terms of where it's found, but it's a C-SPAN video, and if you're not a big fan of C-SPAN, I really am. Brian Lamb was a speaker here once at the university where I teach, and just a very fine gentleman, and they have made all these videos available to people in their video library that go back years. This one, by the way, is April, is this month, this particular segment, so I think you'll enjoy it. Audrey's got a blonde joke for us tonight. Audrey, what's this? Yes, I saw this ahead of time. Okay. Go ahead, Audrey.
Professor Haley, the blonde joke for tonight is not one of our longer ones, but I think our listeners will enjoy it. Here it is. A blonde, brunette and redhead woman decided to compete in the breaststroke division of the English Channel swim competition. The brunette came in first, the redhead second. The blonde finally reached the shore completely exhausted. After being revived with blankets and a drink, she remarked, "I don't want to complain, but I'm pretty sure those other two girls use their arms."
Very good. The blonde only used what she was supposed to use, the breasts. Very good, very good. Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, on a much more serious note, as crime continues across the United States, although it's lower than it's been a long time, it's inching up in some other places, especially those cities where they're laying off all the cops. I would not advise going to Camden, New Jersey, and some of those other places. Camden, I think, laid off 450. We talked about that in a news story a couple 3 months ago. But anyway, we would like the criminals to turn into their firearms, and the Ohio Coalition Against Firearms actually has a public service announcement directed toward criminals so that they can hear this, feel the guilt, and see the need to serve society and go down to turn in their guns. So go ahead, Ohio Coalition.
Carrying concealed handguns in Ohio? It's a deadly idea. A message from the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence.
Thank you very much, Ohio Coalition. It certainly is a deadly idea, and we hope that the right people hear that message and go out and do that. Now, concerning vision, because people on my staff here, our staff, have just gotten glasses recently, and number 761 in terms of a green tip to save the planet. I never thought about this. I've never had these things, but there are people that have them. It has to do with contact lenses. Tip number 761 in Esma Floyd's little book, 1001 Little Ways to Save the Planet. It says, wear your glasses with pride. You know there are people who don't want to wear glasses. They're ashamed of glasses for some reason. They don't think they look good in glasses. But here's what Esma Floyd says. contact lenses, the alternative, are great when it comes to practicality, but the chemicals used for hard lenses and the amount of packaging for disposables made them a bad environmental choice. Save them for sports and special occasions and wear glasses all the other times. There are times when you get pangs of guilt, and I'm sure that there are those out there tonight with contact lenses on, and they've never thought about how bad they've been to the climate. But that 761 in 1,001 little ways to save the planet. Well, let's go ahead and shift to the news tonight and see what we can pick up with, sometimes Evernote. It's still Evernote. I'm not going to abandon Evernote. It's still a great outfit. And we'll see the stories we can pick up. This is the one I can't pick up, so I'll just try to paraphrase what I recall. And this is an interesting one. And the United States Border Patrol, the executives have decided, and I'm sure on a $1 million contract, Janet Napolitano would have to sign up on it, I think. They have contracted with a systems analysis firm in Arizona. And what they've done, they've created a computer game to teach the Border Patrol agents how to catch illegal immigrants. Hold on, it gets worse. This computer game actually covers, if they play it on a big computer screen, actually covers, and you can see this if you search for it on the internet, you'd get the news story because it's fairly recent. In fact, it was on the Drudge Report. And but anyway, they can actually cover 64 square miles of actual mapping, 64 square miles, when in fact what the Border Patrol actually covers in the Southwest is thousands of square miles. But anyway, this covers 64 square miles, and you can actually play the video, and you can actually see a illegal, I'm going to assume they could be from anywhere, but many of them are from Mexico, you can see them sort of a little figure run across the map. Then you see a little Border Patrol van sort of buzz along and pull up and catch them. And that you don't actually see people take them into custody, but they come right up to where the illegal immigrant is standing or was running and was caught. And there, I'm sure, Mike, there must be more to the game, am I correct? There has to be more to the game. But this little game that Homeland Security purchased, thank you for paying your taxes, cost $1 million. I'm not kidding. $1 million. And now let's add to that, I guess you remember hearing, I don't know if we've made, it's dated after the April 2nd, and our show last week was the 1st. I know it was the 31st. But anyway, you've also found that out that the Government Accountability Office actually says that on our southwest border, that's 1,900 miles, who knows, 2,000 miles, whatever it is, that only 129 miles of it is area where the Border Patrol can actually catch people. So 129 miles, our border is relatively secure, where they can actually stop people from coming across, and the other areas are, in fact, not secure. Good news to hear, isn't it? Absolutely incredible. Have you heard about the New York corrections worker? He ran the food service for a prison, and I think it was Conneaut, I can't remember where it was in New York, but anyway, he had this bad habit. He took off every Friday illegally. In other words, he skipped work every day. Want to guess, Audrey, how many times? Emily? Mike, you didn't read the story. Okay. He skipped work every Friday for a consecutive 17 years. I'm not kidding. Then he also did phony contracts that he kicked back to his friends, where his friends probably, I'm assuming, kicked money back to him. That's the reason you would do that. And so he's going to have to pay. He's agreed to pay back $100,000, and he's finally going to go to prison for, I forget what it was, 30 months or something like that. But I can assume the supervision was not real close at the prison where I could skip 17 years of that would be 52 Fridays a year other than your vacation. God would really have his nerve when he had to put in for vacation. He took off every Friday for 17 years and was not caught. Anyway, I thought that was interesting. There's a great story was on the New York Times, which you can no longer get on the internet. You can get 20 stories a month, and the New York Times is choosing a purchase format now for digital content. I think a lot of people were abandoning them, but somehow they think that's gonna help them in the long run in terms of a viable market strategy. But anyway, the story about this guy that sells cigarettes on the streets of New York, he does this illegally. And these smokes, he'll sell like one cigarette for 75 cents or like two of them for a dollar. And the guy's making $250, $300 a day selling these in these cigarettes. Isn't that something? I mean, he's out there selling these things. They're illegal. Every time he sells one, according to the article, he commits a misdemeanor offense, and I'm sure that he sold enough of them, that says one cigarette for 75 cents, two for a dollar. And this guy, they call him Lucy's, because they're not in a pack, I guess. And he's doing real good. He said, people say they count on him coming by and buying a cigarette from him in the morning. He sells cigarettes right out in front of a check cashing storefront. I guess people can't afford. He'll sell a pack for like $8. I have no idea how that marks up, but he's doing real good. At the end of the day, he's going home with $150, something like that. So he's doing pretty good, and it's funny, if they can write a New York Times story about him, wouldn't you think the New York City Police Department would know that he's operating too? That would sound reasonable, but apparently they don't know about him. At least they haven't caught him yet. Here's one that I thought, I don't know how many people like this, but if you have teenagers driving and they're in your family, teenagers do have this one habit of breaking their thumbs by text messaging. So they've come up with an answer to that, and they're putting cameras about the size of a cigarette pack, as a matter of fact, or a deck of cards. It'll actually fit on the rearview mirror of the car, and this can be attached there, and they'll monitor the activity both inside and outside of the car. If the driver gets in a wreck or suddenly swerves or accelerates, or the video clip is sent wirelessly to a website where the parents can watch it. So your parents, and who knows who else, can actually watch virtually everything that your teenager is doing in the car if you have this camera installed. In fact, you can click on this news story and actually go watch some of the cameras in operation. It's called DriveCam from one company. It makes it. It's called DriveCam. They offer the camera for $495 and charge $50 for installation. Then it costs $30 a month. I have the driving data sent to professional driving analysts. And the next thing we'll do will be, who knows who will be monitoring that way, but absolutely incredible. Would you, if you're the teenager, I'm not sure how excited you'd be about everything you're doing in your vehicle being monitored. I suppose if they try to turn it off, that sends a signal also. Maybe it turns off your car or something like that. But as we move toward the total surveillance society, I don't know what you think, but I suppose we could make some claim that this saves lives or something like that. But I think it's a little too intrusive. That's how I would see this myself. Well, wouldn't you know it, the federal government is going for more regulations. And one of the things they want to do now is they want to, let me get this story. They want to have all restaurants that sell food, or they have at least 280 locations in the United States or something. Now, Evernote lost this one. Huh. Where the heck did that go? It's gone. Anyway, I remember the story. That if they have over 200 and some locations in the United States, they must now start or post on their website the calories and every item that's on their menu. And the Food and Drug Administration has announced, they say this in the article, they've decided that America is too obese. They've decided that. I'd like to get a lineup. Wouldn't that be interesting, Mike, to get a lineup of all the FDA employees to work for the federal government. What is it, about 14 million and expanding? It's not that many, but they're probably heading toward that. And see how obese they are. Oh, and my own bias on this whole thing is, who cares? I mean, really, if somebody wants to be 20 over, 100 over, 13 under, whatever, it's your choice. That's what America's about. So anyway, that's an interesting story. The FDA, there's so many ways that they can expand their authority that we can never even begin to count it. So we'll have to see if that happens. So if you're going to go to Burger King or someplace like that, you're going to have to, they'll have to have their, do they, McDonald's already has that, don't they? I'm not sure. I thought they did. But anyway, yeah, in New York they do, because that's right, Mayor Bloomberg, excuse me, Bloomberg, makes them do that in New York State. All right, we're going to try to see what we can do. Give us a minute. We're using the old technology here from speaker to cell phone, and we're going to try to hear this segment called Countering Radicalization in the United States. And these are going to be some people that are really informed on the topic. So give us a second, and I think you'll enjoy this segment.
Thank you very much. My name is Dina Temple Raskin, and I'm the counterterrorism correspondent at National Public Radio. And I want to welcome you to the third session of today's symposium, Intelligence and Counter-Radicalization. Once again, if you could please completely turn off your cell phones, not on vibrate, but completely turn them off. I'm always guilty of leaving it on vibrate. And as a reminder, this session is on the record. The last session is off the record. So we can't refer to anything, please, that we heard in the last session. That goes for our speakers, too, because that was completely off the record. So in this session, what we're going to do is we're going to... compare and contrast the linkages between intelligence and law enforcement in the U.S. and the U.K. and generally see how violent extremism has changed the business of intelligence. And for this session, we have the world's most perfect panel, and that would be to start with Charles Allen, who's at the CIA for more than 40 years and basically was in intelligence longer than I've been alive, and people that I have... it's a compliment. The people I spoke to about Mr. Allen referred to him as a legend, and I've never actually interviewed a legend before, so I'm looking forward to that. Bill Bratton is known as the smartest cop in America, and if you don't already know a lot about him, it would suffice to say that he is the only person alive or dead to have led the two largest police forces in the United States, NYPD and the LAPD. And last but not least, I'm pleased to have Peter Clark from the UK with us today. With all this focus on the royal wedding, you might be interested to know that he used to be in charge of the Royalty and Diplomatic Protection Department. That means he was in charge of protecting the royal family and its residences. I was looking for a way to try to get Prince William and Kate into this conversation, but I couldn't find a smooth transition. So we're going to focus instead on his other job, which was as the former head of the anti-terrorist branch at Scotland Yard. You have their bios in your sheets, but that gives you sort of an idea of the caliber of person we're going to be speaking with today. And before we get all breathless about extremism, I thought we would start by using some definitions and defining the issue about how bad the scope is here in the United States and how bad it is in the UK. And perhaps you could give me a number, 10 being the greatest amount of extremism and 1 being very little. And what number would you think corresponds to the U.S. and to the U.K.? Mr. Allen, to start?
Well, I would start with very moderate terms because extremism has grown in this society in certain areas, in small pockets around our broad, large country. But the actual numbers has been a very tiny minority. I believe that the scope and size of this needs to be debated more publicly. That was where I was hoping Chairman Keane would start his his hearing with trying to size the issue. When you look at the number of cases of people indicted between 2001 and the end of 2010, it's relatively small. I think 176 individuals, according to Iran statistics. It doesn't mean it's insignificant. It grew. We in 2009, 2010, we had about 35 cases, but we only averaged between 2001 and 2008 about 4 cases a year. I think that's pretty small. And how much growth has occurred, I don't think we have a good handle, and I think it's one of the disconnects that I believe that we have to address in the future.
How about you, Mr. Bratton? If you were to put it on a 1 to 10 basis, where are we?
Well, in terms of the United States, I think, particularly in Charlie's comments, much less of an issue than it is my colleagues, what they deal with in Britain. The briefings I received when I go over there and meet with the Met, it was frightening to me in the sense of all that they were dealing with, and Peter can speak much more to that. And at the same time, with what I thought to be a very significant set of issues versus what we were dealing with in the United States and my city, Los Angeles, and prior at New York, that this seemed to be less public concern and focus on the issue than here in the United States with what seems to be a much smaller problem in terms of both actual cases as well as the unknown, which is what's going on out there that we don't know about.
Mm-hmm. So more breathless here is what you're saying, even though there's less.
There's I think, almost in some respects, much more public attention to the issue here. And maybe that's because of some of the limitations that the British press have relative to what they can report on relative to these cases. Up even after the incident during all the various aspects of the investigation, the court case.
Mm-hmm. We like that about here.
I'm sure you do.
and Mr. Clark, how about you?
I don't think I can put a number on it. If the question is it serious and enduring in the United Kingdom, I'll say absolutely yes. Our last security minister before the Baroness was an admiral, and he once described himself as a simple sailor. Because I suppose I'm a simple policeman, and I tend to think of this in terms of criminality. When we're analysing criminals, what do they say? Do they have the motive, the means, and the opportunity to commit their crimes? So if we think of this terrorism in a similar way, do they have the motive? Well, question, have any of the underpinning issues giving rise to a sense of grievance gone away? My analysis is no. Do they have the means? Yes. We've seen in the UK very low-tech, very low-cost attacks. People killed by the kitchen sink bomb makers. Do they have the opportunities? Well, yes, of course, because in any open society there are vulnerabilities. But also the opportunities that arise in terms of radicalization. We often talk about ungoverned spaces being fertile breeding grounds. Well, my view is that we have internal ungoverned spaces. And in particular, those ungoverned spaces are in universities, in mosques, and in prisons. And I don't think we're anywhere near yet addressing these issues yet. The government has been putting out guidance, for instance, to the further education sector. And there has been pushback about this. Recently, a spokesman for the Association of Teachers and Lecturers in the UK said that more monitoring was a bad thing, in essence, and it's not for the educational authorities to police. Well, if it's not for the educational authorities, who is it for? So is there a role for intelligence and law enforcement within the further education establishment? Seems to be controversial, but these are issues that need to be debated very openly and honestly.
And this gets to our main point, which is this intersection of law enforcement and intelligence. And presumably, when intelligence works the right way, it helps make the distinction between, as you were saying last night, between the vulnerable and the malevolent. So that's what I wanted to talk about a little bit today. This challenge, Mr. Allen, if you could address, have they been successful at making that distinction here in the United States?
Well, I think we're moving in that direction in ways that we did not have Homeland Security intelligence on September 11, 2001. But with the formation of the Department of Homeland Security, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, changing the way it operates, forming an intelligence directorate of 2,600 analysts, putting those analysts in the field with their 56 stations, I think there has been, and the emphasis on trying to understand what is occurring in this country, the degree of radicalization, to try to not only look strictly at a predicate where you can open a case, but look to see if there can be intelligence tips or leads. I really do believe that part of our response here is it will come, I believe, from the community, from the bottom up. The people that know the community are police departments. There are 18,500 of those across the country. Not all of them have intelligence elements. Los Angeles, of course, does and did under Chief Patton. New York has an excellent one. But to get a better understanding and to be able to really work on tips and leads, the police departments in our country are very diverse. They sort of reflect the neighborhoods where they do their work. And I just believe that we're in the early stages of blending intelligence and law enforcement. And I think a lot more can be done while still protecting the privacy, civil rights, and civil liberties of all Americans. I think we have to be very careful about this, but I do believe we're headed in the right direction in building Homeland Security. Homeland Security is, as a degree now, is being taught in many universities across this country. I've met many of the professors, many of the deans of universities when I was Undersecretary of Homeland Security. So I think we're in the right direction. I do believe we have a good deal to go.
I think everybody agrees, Chief Bratton, that the key component here is outreach to Muslim communities. Can you talk a little bit about what's working, what's not working, what you think we should be doing?
Sure. Sally talked about the blending of intelligence with law enforcement, with policing. And post 9/11, that has been accelerating, off to a slow start, but the blending is important because one of the previous speakers talked about the nature of intelligence agents is that they're pessimists. They're always worrying about what they don't know, what's going on. American policing, based on the successes that we achieved in the 1990s and are continuing into the 21st century in our traditional role of dealing with crime, improving community relations, we tend to be much more optimistic. I'm an optimist. And in the 1990s, when American policing led the assault on traditional crime with ideas like community policing, with ideas like problem solving, crime mapping, CompStat, broken windows, those ideas percolated from the local level. And that was important because the people that were being impacted by that crime problem were community. The federal government partnership was essential, funding, COPS program, research. Similarly, now in this new era with the new crime issue, the optimism of the local law enforcement community is critically important. And Charlie can speak to this because during his time serving as Secretary Chertoff, they really opened up Homeland Security to allowing local law enforcement a place at the table. Because local chiefs understood that in dealing with this new form of threat, the idea of, and as we've seen, an increasing threat in the homeland rather than coming from the external areas that had previously been a problem, that local police were going to have to be a valuable part at the table. With one out of optimism from our successes in the 90s, and those successes in the 90s can help to inform the continuing successes into the 21st century. First, as Charlie pointed out, the level of the problem is still relatively small. The potential to grow, and it has been accelerating, but the numbers are still really very small versus what the Brits are dealing with. And our sophistication, our intelligence gathering efforts, the coordination is improving, and I think improving at a rate faster than the growth of the problem. So that as we move forward trying to deal with the issue of trying to prevent the growth of radicalization, nobody is better positioned to do that than the local police, because our successes in the 90s were reaching into the community. In the 70s and 80s, we were isolated from the community, a thin blue line. The Los Angeles police department was the model of that. We'll take care of business, and you stay over there. And the business we were going to take care of was the crime problems in the African-American community. Well, now we have the problem, the perceived problem of the crime issue, the terrorist issue in the Muslim community. And who better to reach into that community than local police who learned in the 90s that to deal with crime, you have to develop relationships. And we are getting much better at that. So in Los Angeles, a significant amount of our time is spent learning about the Muslim community, reaching into it, understanding how diverse it is. We tend to think of this as monolithic entity, and it is not that. It is incredibly diverse, like the rest of American society. So we are, I think, on the right path. So much more to be done. But I think we have been formed by the mistakes of the 70s and 80s and what we learned in the 90s.
Let me talk about an issue that brings together some of the tension of intelligence and law enforcement, and that would be the issue of stings. You remember back in Thanksgiving, there was a Somali American kid, 20-something from Seattle, who allegedly wanted to detonate a car bomb at a local Christmas tree lighting. The FBI found him, I think, in the chat room. I think I have this right. And they stepped in and basically provided him with what he needed for the operation: fake explosives, detonators, vans, telephone to dial to supposedly detonate this. Depending on which side of the fence you're on, some people see this as entrapment. Some people see this as good police work. Mr. Allen, if I could start with you, can you talk about these kinds of operations and what they represent in terms of the intersection of intelligence and law enforcement?
Well, I'm an intelligence officer, not a law enforcement officer, but the FBI, I believe, has been very careful in the way it operates when it comes to the stings. There's been a small number of them, hasn't been a large number of them. And you have to remember that the FBI would operate on tips, leads, where they would see someone who has become radicalized, who is moving to advocate or engage or be willing to engage in violent actions. I think the FBI has operated under some very tough rules and guidelines over the years. And from my perspective, this is a fine line. As an intelligence officer, it's something that is a little foreign to me. But I believe in this case that the FBI, working with the Department of Justice, has handled this, I think, quite well. And the numbers are not great. But you've got to remember there's one thing here, and that's the intent. The intent, in a number of cases, and we had a couple after Abdel Matalib was tried to blow up a plane in Detroit. We had a couple of sting operations that were brought to closure by the Bureau. If the intent was to inflict damage, to kill innocents, to hurt U.S. critical infrastructure. So it's a fine line to walk. Being an intelligence officer is one that I'm not as comfortable with as perhaps law enforcement, but I believe the Bureau has operated very effectively and very carefully in this arena.
Now, I'll get to you in a second, Mr. Clark, about how you can't do this in the UK, but I wanted to say quickly, Chief Bratton, can you talk a little bit about the effect these kinds of operations have in the community? It has a chilling effect, one would assume.
Well, from a law enforcement perspective, stings are a part of what we do, that, whether it's internal affairs issues directed at our own police officers or in the traditional criminal world directed at criminals. In the NYPD, we created sting operations. We're doing hundreds of them directed against our own officers. In the LAPD, as part of the federal consent decree, they were required that we effectively set up stings to see if officers were accepting citizen complaints. Charlie points out correctly that they have to be done appropriately. They have to be done in a way that they are not subject to criticism. The use of stings in this new paradigm, the new crime, and particularly with the sensitivities of the population, in this case particularly the Muslim population, that it is a thin line that has to be followed. I think the Bureau, my understanding of their cases, without having instances of them other than one or two that we dealt with in L.A., that I think they've done a very good job here. But what has been missing is the relationship between whether it's the Bureau or local police to be able to explain, to be trusted, if you will, to explain, and to have a level of transparency that that we are able to show what we're doing, why we're doing it, how we're doing it. Which seems incredibly valuable also for the intelligence that's gathered from it. How was this individual radicalized? What was the chain of events that brought him to him or her to a point where they were going to take this type of overt action? Are there others out there that are involved? So they are an incredibly useful intelligence gathering opportunity also.
And there's also a sense, I guess, that if you get the community involved or community leaders involved earlier in the process, then they aren't surprised by the headline, which is the point of the problem.
In dealing with the gang problem in Los Angeles, we were continually going into neighborhoods, minority neighborhoods, flashbang, going into drug houses, really making a big scene. And the neighbors would come out and they would be concerned because the traditional police response was, go away. What we changed was basically we would go in, we would move the whole group of community service officers as we were finishing up the action. Those officers were working through the neighborhood. This is why we're here. It's the complaints we received about this drug activity, this violence associated with this house. We're responding to your issues and concerns. So that's where American policing began to learn to basically be inclusive rather than exclusive. Instead of just saying, people, go away. Instead, come here, let me tell you what we're doing, why we're here, what we're doing. You may all remember the movie Chinatown, and everybody always thinks the last line of that movie in Chinatown. This is Chinatown, Jake. The last line of that movie was the lieutenant turning around to the crowd and saying, get off the streets. Well, that's effectively the way we police. Get off the streets. Instead, yeah, let me tell you what's going on, why we're here. And that's what needs to change.
And, Mr. Clark, can you talk a little bit about how this doesn't happen in the UK and why?
Well, it's not quite true to say it doesn't happen because we have conducted some operations, not many, about two that I can recall over the last 6 or 7 years, where undercover officers have been used. But the parameters of what is permissible within the UK law is very different from what it is here in the United States. But I think the important thing is that we've tried to use the criminal trial process as a means of showing the objectivity and integrity of the counter-terrorist effort in the United Kingdom. And the intelligence community has had a huge part to play in that. And I think MI5 deserves a huge amount of credit for the way in which they've moved into the evidential arena and worked incredibly closely with the police service, looking for evidential opportunities, because the openness of the criminal trial process as a means of demonstrating to communities what we're trying to do on their behalf. I think with a sting operation, and indeed with any operation which moves you upstream and usually if it's on the grounds of public safety, there is an issue around perception within communities. And certainly it's been expressed by some that thought crime is something for which people are being punished. And indeed, there are some aspects of some UK legislation glorifying terrorism, for instance, which I find confusing, let alone everybody else, what it actually means. So I think it's very important that we are very careful about what perceptions we generate when we carry out certain types of operations. And but in broad terms, certainly in the UK, it would not be permissible to run an operation where the objective was to find how far somebody would be prepared to go given the opportunity.
Which makes it very different from the United States.
Makes it very different from the United States.
Okay.
May I add a point on this?
Please.
We were behind back in 2008 with some Somali community in this country, and we had a lot of meetings. I remember a meeting on Veterans Day at the White House just trying to get our arms around it with the FBI, with intelligence agencies, and I think we did that fairly effectively. One of the things I think is very important to remember that in places like St. Paul, Minneapolis, St. Paul, we found that the local communities, the parents started reaching out to the Bureau some, but also to the local police in a major way. So I think something that can be very positive sometimes when a sting operation is executed, we do find that the communities do respond. If we do the policing the way Chief Patton just described.
Well, now we're going to invite some audience members to join the discussion. If you could please wait for the microphone and speak directly into it, and stand, state your name and your affiliation. And if we could keep those questions as concise as possible, that would be great. And one other reminder, anything that you learned an hour ago from the last session, please don't refer to it in your question. Yes, sir, in front here. Please wait for the microphone.
John Gannon from VA Systems, formerly of the U.S. Intelligence Committee, and the terrific panel. Really appreciate your very thoughtful comments. We heard this morning something we've heard frequently from our own government, and that is that the threat is from Islamic extremism, not from Islam. But that's hardly an endorsement of Islam. And I think the way that gets translated down to, in some cases, to local law enforcement is, well, they're not all bad. But you have to figure out who the good ones are and the bad guys are. But when you look at a strategy for intelligence collection or for investigation, how do you deal with? Is it a religious issue? If it's Islamic extremism, that's religion. But is it religion? Is it ideology? Is it politically driven, or is it some criminal activity? Because that would seem to me to be an issue for how you develop a collection system, where you go to collect, same thing with investigations. So what is it, religion we're talking about, or is it ideology, or what is it when we talk about radical, the radical threat that we're facing?
I look on it not as religion, John, but I look on it as extremism, the manifestations of which is political Islamism. It's very hard and for local police and local law enforcement to understand that. I really do believe that this is where a lot of work has to be done. There are instructors. I sent people out to talk about these issues. We had a whole Office of Civil Rights, Civil Liberties, Dan Sutherland, who really held the round tables in all major cities, continues to do so under the National Counterterrorism Center. These things are very effective, but if we confuse Islam with what is occurring with those who are advocating violent, what I call Islamic extremism, ideological extremism, then we get confused. And I think there's a lot of confusion across the country, some of it on both sides of the spectrum, politically here in this country, which seems to fuel this kind of, I think, misconception. I think from the intelligence perspective at Homeland Security, we worked extremely hard with Secretary Chertoff to get this right. We even put out a brochure which looked at political terminology and the care with which we should use certain languages, our language very carefully, and we did this. I believe, though, we have a very major task to work with state and local governments, with our fusion centers, there's 72 of them, to start explaining this in a more articulate way as part of the intelligence training. We don't have an easy and immediate answer on how to do this, but we are in the right direction. The new undersecretary took my position, very much is concerned about this and is working very closely with Secretary Napolitano and others on these issues. But I'll turn to Chief Bratton. I know he has a lot more ideas on this than I do.
This is where we can really learn from the past and both the successes and failures. 70s, 80s, I came into prison in 1970, the whole issue of crime beginning its upward spiral for the next 20 some odd years. And so much of that crime was within the African American community, mostly committed against the African American community. But the idea of policing, a lot of what went on in policing and LAPD in particular, was really an occupying force in Los Angeles and almost at war with the African American community, when the issue was really particularly the gang component located in that community, some 20,000, a huge number, but in a population of well over a million. And the policy of policing at that time was really one of staying apart from the community. And it wasn't until the late 80s, 90s, where the concept of community policing, with its three elements, partnership, problem-solving, prevention,
where we began to change. The partnership wasn't just with the alphabet agencies, the FBI, DEA, being able to utilize their skills and their FICO statutes, but most importantly, the idea of measuring our success by reaching into that African-American community, the leadership, understanding the diverse aspects of it, and separating the problem portion of that population, the gang population, from that, focusing on that group, but talking with and listening to. And some of our actions were controversial. For example, several years ago, we began to work very actively with gang interventions. My rank-and-file cops didn't want anything to do with them because they saw them as gangbangers who were literally basically just deceiving us by appearing to go straight. But in the African-American and Latino communities, these were their fathers, their sons, their brothers, who they felt the police were not supporting their efforts to go straight. But once we started trying to find ways to work with them, we set up academies with Connie Rice, the civil rights advocate, to work with them, the community began to see us in a different way. Similarly with the issue you raised about religion, if we are going to demonize a whole group of people because of their religion, when it's a small group that are trying to use that religion to inspire their own purposes, then we're going to lose. And that's why the efforts to understand that community is so essential, because, quite frankly, we really don't. Up until 9/11 and coming back in a policing, I couldn't have told you the difference between a Shia or Sunni Muslims. I thought they were all alike. And now we understand clearly they are not. There are many sects and beliefs. So a long-winded answer to that, but let's learn from the past, the successes and the failures. And we failed in the 70s and 80s and the 90s, and now into the 21st century, we're beginning to see a lot of that can work with this issue.
So you think some of the things that you learned in trying to stop gangs will actually be applicable to this?
Definitely. Even as I was having a discussion with a senior British official last day or so relative to this conference, and the idea of, in a sense, how do you get intelligence about what's going on in that portion of the community, in the case of the gang community, in the case of the radicals, how do you elicit getting into that group? And very often policing the tactics have been, I had not really thought about this, to coerce an informant, the threat of jail, the threat of actions against the family, versus the new thinking and the idea that there are other ways to do this without coercion to access. And it's an expansion of the thinking about how to approach this problem, to try new ideas, and the idea of sharing what has been largely a British initiative with American policing. And I'm very intrigued by that because the experience we have is a shared experience. We come at it from different perspectives sometimes, different laws certainly, but we can learn so much from each other. And some of our strength in this issue is that the exchange between British and American police services has been very extensive. I used to spend a lot of time in London. Well, I love London, but there's always an excuse to get over there. But they were so far ahead of us on this issue, so far ahead of us in many respects at the local police level.
Do you want to comment on that, Richard?
I entirely agree with all that. Many of the fundamental features and principles of policing apply to this as to any other type of criminality, and I think that's the important thing. But basically, I said earlier, a simple policeman, these are violent criminals looking to kill people, to kill their fellow citizens, and we mustn't lose sight of that. I think it's terribly important as well that there are consistent messages about this, and I have to say I was really disappointed last year. And you remember Umar Farooq Abdulmutallab and his father had gone in to the United States Embassy in Lagos, I believe it was, expressing concerns about his son's behavior and where it was taking him.
This is the Detroit bomber. Go ahead.
Indeed. And Amanda was then a serving British government minister, went on to BBC Question Time from a mosque in South London and said that his Abdulmutallab's father had snitched on him. I think that's the most unfortunate use of language. You wouldn't use that language about any other type of crime. You wouldn't use it about a concerned parent going to the police because they were fearful that their child was perhaps getting involved in drugs. It should be allowed to be expressed as a proper expression of concern. We shouldn't put this into a different category.
Other questions? How about way back there in the back?
Heidi Noonan, Fox News Channel. this question is for Mr. Allen in regards to Yemen and al-Qaeda. What does it mean that AQAP has declared the Arabian province an Islamic emirate to be governed by Sharia?
Which province? I'm sorry, I didn't
hear. Arabian province.
Oh, yes. Okay, I'm buying. I don't know that it has a great deal of ramifications. AQAP, we know that it is active and aggressive, and conditions may be more favorable if President Saleh does not survive and more ungoverned space develops within Yemen. It gets back to the idea of a despotic ruler versus an anarchical, ideological-driven elements within a area that can cause a great deal of problems for the West and for the very area, for all of the and for the stability of the Arabian Peninsula, which we all know is very important to us. I don't know that that in itself has that much resonance. AQAP is under a lot of pressure. Al-Awlaki is under a lot of pressure. We hear Anwar al-Awlaki, but there are other leaders within within AQAP, which we know well, which are very important, more hardened, more operationally experienced than al-Awlaki. So I don't think we should overstate this. I think what we should have concerns about is the whole stability of the Arabian Peninsula as a result of what is occurring within Yemen, and we lack a great deal of in-depth understanding, but I'm not more concerned than I was. We are concerned and have been concerned over the last 3 years over Yemen. It's not something we learned only when al-Awlaki became a popular name back here in the United States.
Question on our subject at hand, the intelligence and counter-radicalization. How about the gentleman back there in the blue shirt, who's raising his hands right by the microphone? There you go.
Hi, Jonathan Brown, Georgetown University. You mentioned methods for dealing with this in terms of community policing, dealing with some of these communities facing kind of gang problems as opposed to ideological problems. But in the U.S. at least, how do we encourage community members to, let's say, talk to police about their children they might be concerned about when the punishments that have been dealt out are so severe, with things like terrorism enhancement sentencing, where people are getting 20 years for lying to a federal officer, 40 years for perjury? I mean, these in the case of the DC 6, I think, and also in some of the Somali Americans who went to fight with Shabab, it was the parents who turned them in. But why would a parent turn in their child when they're almost certainly going to be in jail for 30 years?
Specifically during the Minneapolis case, you recall that many of the mothers didn't want to tell the police that their kids were gone because they thought if their kids came back, they might be sent to Guantanamo. Who would like to answer
that? Make a comment on this. This is not the first time this problem's arisen. We had it in the United Kingdom, where concerned parents did come in some years ago expressing concerns about their son. And unfortunately, at that time,
well, you can go to cfan.org and see the rest of that. It's called Countering Radicalization Panel, and it was April 1, 2011. So this was last week, a very interesting discussion and a good discussion between what goes on in two countries confronting the same problem. Certainly we're not as severe as what's going on in Great Britain. So hope you enjoyed that, and we'll be seeing you next week and check and see what we're going to be doing. And here's Vera Lynn to sign us off as she usually does.
We'll meet again. Don't know when. Don't know when. But I know we'll meet again some sunny day. Like you always do, till the blue sky drives the dark clouds far away. So tell them I won't be long. They'll be happy to know that as you saw me go, I was singing this song. We'll meet again. Don't know where, don't know what.